human fathers anyway, who are not in fact gods, so they sometimes make themselves up to be, cannot entirely fulfill.
And just briefly, Augustine, before I let you go, have you adapted any of the historical advice you found in the book for your own kids?
Well, that's a great question. At the beginning of the story, way back before the historical record, way back before the human cultural record, fatherhood seems to have evolved from a fish, a male fish, who was asked to help protect eggs that were harvested and fertilized, that were fertilized and hatched outside the mother's body. Linguists think that we hear the word pa, fa, da, ta, which is common across cultures, as a request for help because it activates in our brains a part that evolved from this fish who was asked to help.
And we are all still taking that cue now. Augustine Sedgwick, author of Fatherhood, A History of Love and Power. Thanks very much for joining me. And that's it from me on The Times at One this week. Aisha Hazarika is here from 1 p.m. tomorrow. And now Jane and Fee are next here on Times Radio.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you very much, Patrick. Now, don't be alarmed, people. In case you think Jane's really changed after a brief holiday, you are listening to Fee Glover and Tom Whipple on Times Radio.
Coming up on the show today, first, my apologies for not being Jane. An irresponsible splurge. Keir Starmer goes after Nigel Farage's spending plans and battles accusations that the Reform leader just speaks human a little bit better. Tens of thousands of Russians are amassing to the north of Ukraine. Could the Kremlin be about to open a new front in the war? It's morning in America, with markets joyous and the White House furious after Donald Trump's tariff policy was ruled illegal. And we've got a few sciencey stories for you too, including an interview with Richard Dawkins. Plus, why is ham the new turkey twizzler, the new villain in our primary schools?
It will be a packed programme all in the next 2 hours after the news with Andy Hayes.
Hey, good afternoon. The Prime Minister has described Nigel Farage's economic policies as a mad experiment and urged voters not to fall for Reform UK's promises. Farage is committed to scrapping the two-child benefit cap and reinstating winter fuel payments if he wins the next election. But Sir Keir Starmer says he's promising tax cuts without a funding plan, just like a former Tory PM.
Billions upon billions of completely unfunded spending. Precisely the sort of irresponsible splurge that sent your mortgage costs, your bills, through the roof. It's Liz Truss all over again.
But Reform UK chairman Zia Yusuf says lots of public spending is wasted and large savings could be made. Police say a 9-year-old child was among those injured when a car drove into people at Liverpool FC's title parade on Monday. Officers say the ages of the victims range from 9 to 78, all are understood to be British. Police have until this evening to question a 53-year-old man from West Derby in Liverpool on suspicion of attempted murder, dangerous driving and drug driving. It's understood Donald Trump will appeal a US court's decision to block his global tariffs. A 3-judge panel has concluded the president exceeded his authority when announcing further taxes on foreign-made goods. Trump biographer David K. Johnson has told Times Radio the commander-in-chief is out of control.
Donald believes that as president, he is America's dictator. In fact, he has said, I have an Article 2, referring to part of the U.S. Constitution, that says I can do anything I want. And he has been behaving in this administration as America's dictator, removing sources of accountability like inspectors general.
Robert Jenrick, the shadow justice secretary, has confronted fare dodgers on the London Underground. He claims law-breaking is out of control in the capital. Transport for London says about one in every 25 passengers is not paying, but Jenrick says he fears it's a lot more serious than that. He's told Times Radio's Hugo Rifkin that this sort of crime is chipping away at society.
I do think that we all have a role in society to call people out. If you see somebody chucking litter on the floor, it's not somebody else's problem. Frankly, it's not just the police who should step up or the local council.
One of the men you spoke to said he was carrying a knife, didn't he?
He said that to me, yeah. Yeah, no, he threatened me. Look, I don't want anyone to put themselves in danger.
A drought has been declared in northwest England. The Environment Agency says the regions had the third lowest rainfall between February and April since 1871. Experts are warning people to be mindful about their water usage as reservoir and river levels remain low. And a woman from South Wales is offering a £500 reward to help find her 43-year-old tortoise. Anne Thatcher from Neath describes Sesame as a family member who's witnessed many milestones over the years. He requires medication after damaging his shell last year. It's more than a month since he was last seen. And for a roundup of the news on demand, subscribe to the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app and via your smart speaker. Weekday afternoons on Times Radio, sponsored by Solar with Hive.
Thank you, Andy. It's 5 minutes past two. Surely Sesame can't have got far. Welcome to Thursday afternoon. It's Tom Whipple Day, and I know you were all thinking it. When, oh, when was the afternoon show going to have a science person on? He's the science editor of The Times. He's extraordinarily welcome. We reflect that slant today with our big interview after 3:30. Who is it, Tom?
It is with the great Richard Dawkins. As science person and tortoise owner, I want to stand up against tortoise prejudice, so they can really go like the clappers when it is warm, and particularly when they've got a love interest in sight. Okay. Ours follows the robot mower with great ardour.
Right. Has it borne fruit?
No. I mean, it's been bad for both the mower and the tortoise, to be perfectly honest. We have to keep them apart.
Okay, I do need some facts now. How fast is your tortoise going?
Well, as fast as a robot mower, I would guess a slow walking pace on a warm day, when he's really up for it. When it's cold, he doesn't move, but that's how I feel too.
Well, I revert to my previous statement. He can't have got far.
He's at a month.
At a slow walking pace. It's a small radius. Let's not have a row. All of your politics will happen on the programme this afternoon. Keir Starmer is talking about Reform's unfunded tax pledges, whilst Robert Jenrick is chasing down fare dodgers in a newly released citizen kind of arrest video where one young man who has pushed through the barriers simply tells him to F off. It is quite a political stunt. Why can't we get school food right? That's another question we're going to ask this afternoon. It's quite key stage one, isn't it, to know that highly processed meat isn't good for you, and it's certainly not good for your kids. Today's story is about taking ham off the menu in schools. A new report suggests that we do this. We will discuss why we really are stuck on repeat here. Tom is going to bring us news of GM plants as well. What's that story about?
A whole bunch of modified, or, well, the language is important, something we might get into, but genetically tweaked potatoes are being planted today in a field in East Anglia, and this used to be something that would provoke mass protests and crop burnings and all sorts of things, but it seems like we've sort of quietly moved on from Frankenfoods, or have we? We'll be chatting to the scientists behind it.
Excellent. We remain Jane and Fee at times.radio if you want to email the programme this afternoon. We are 0333 003 2353, and Jane Mulcairns will end the show with her usual aplomb at 3:45 with a sneak preview of the Saturday Times magazine. So here we go. Most read stories.
Well, so the most read stories on the website this afternoon. At number three, we have, I'm 61, I've lost 5 stone, and I've got my best body ever, says Alison Cork. She's told the Times how she completely transformed her approach to life and exercise. Coming in at number two, in my best Tony Blackburn, we have, who's buying London's most expensive new flats? More than £600 million worth of luxury homes is in the capital have been quietly sold, and the Times has worked out who's behind them, and you can find out on the website. And the most read piece on the Times website is, well, it is Robert Jenrick, as he confronts the tube fare dodgers. The Shadow Justice Secretary says the state needs to reassert itself in a video of himself challenging London Underground passengers. He spoke to Times Radio a little earlier, and we will be discussing this again in a moment. You can read all these stories on thetimes.com. You'll need your digital subscription, and if you don't have one, get one. Go to thetimes.com/subscribe. There's also a fantastic offer on right now for the TLS, the Times Literary Supplement. Every week, the TLS has book reviews, essays and poems by leader writers and thinkers from around the world. you can get your first 4 months for just £1 a month. And I think it's leading writers, not leader writers, actually. I don't think our leader writers have been drafted into the TLS. It's not their kind of thing. They're sort of not fey and poetic. They're more sort of robust and angry.
I'm definitely not getting involved in that.
Anyway, well, make the most of this offer, and whether leading writers or leader writers, go to the-tls.co.uk.
So we will talk about Bobby J. Perhaps we should do a bingo card of what Robert Jenrick would like to do to draw our attention to him next. We'll punt that one out to you. Be quite careful. But we're going to start talking about reform. Get Nigel. It is the broad theme of the Prime Minister's speech today, attacking Reform UK. Keir Starmer's branded Nigel Farage's spending plans. Liz Truss all over again, calling them an irresponsible splurge. Times Radio's political correspondent Theo Usherwood has been listening to the Prime Minister today. So for people who are just joining us, what's the top line from the speech?
So Reform only has five MPs and we're 4 years out from a general election. Nevertheless, the Prime Minister felt it necessary to respond to Nigel Farage's speech in central London on Tuesday by travelling all the way up to a glass factory in the northwestern St Helens to give his riposte to a floor of British workers at a British factory. Of course, central to what Nigel Farage had to say on Tuesday was his points when it came to welfare spending. He wants to increase the personal allowance when it comes to income tax up to £20,000. That would cost 50 to 80 billion, according to the Institute for Fiscal Studies. He wants to scrap the two-child benefit cap. That costs 3.5 billion. He's parking his proverbial tanks on Labour's lawn, and that's why Keir Starmer felt it necessary to give this speech and bring back memories of what happens, in his view, if you are financially irresponsible.
And that's the question you have to ask about Nigel Farage. Can you trust him? Can you trust him with your future? Can you trust him with your jobs? Can you trust him with your mortgages, your pensions, your bills? And he gave the answer on Tuesday, a resounding no. He set out economic plans that contain billions upon billions of completely unfunded spending, precisely the sort of irresponsible splurge that sent your mortgage costs, your bills and the cost of living through the roof. It's Liz Truss all over again.
So irresponsible splurge is the phrase that presumably Keir Starmer is hoping we really latch on to here.
Yes, and of course he's trying to, as I say, bring back those memories of when Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng came up with that mini-budget in the 49 days of the Truss premiership. She cut corporation tax and we saw the markets didn't like it. We saw the pound collapse against the dollar. Billions had to be pumped into the system to stop the financial markets crashing. And then as a result of that, we saw interest rates at the same time soar in response to inflation hitting 11%. And what Keir Starmer is saying is that if we do this all over again with Nigel Farage and the fact that he doesn't balance the books with what he was proposing on Tuesday, then you're going to see your bills go up, you're going to see your mortgages go up, and it's going to be Liz Truss Mark II.
What do you make of Nigel Farage's allure? He's got a lot of support, but an awful lot of people aren't keen on him either. Do you think he is a character who you can use evidence and statistics and change people's minds about? I mean, so far, he is definitely... he appears to be someone who, if you have a strong feeling about him, you don't really want to be dissuaded from that position.
No, it's an interesting one. A point that you raise here, Fee. So, you according to YouGov and the Times and many other pollsters, Nigel Farage consistently is now polling at around 30%. Sometimes a little bit over, sometimes a little bit under, but he's hitting 30%. Then you get onto the question about Nigel Farage being a prime minister, and you compare him to Keir Starmer and to Kemi Badenoch. And he actually compares less favourably. So amongst his supporters, they love him. But amongst those people who don't support him, he's a Marmite figure. So they loathe him. They prefer anybody else but Nigel Farage. So in the latest polling that was out from YouGov yesterday, in a head-to-head choice about who would be the best prime minister, Starmer beats Farage 44 to 29. Badenoch beats Farage 29-25. He still hasn't managed to crack that 30% going beyond, going into territory where actually reform would command an overall majority in the House of Commons. And that was a huge part of Tuesday's speech, was to broaden his appeal beyond those who we would naturally think as being as Farage fans and reform supporters.
Yeah, and as you said, we're still a long way out, aren't we? The two-child benefit cap after the rowback on winter fuel, it's the new issue that is dogging the Prime Minister, isn't it?
And of course, this was problematic for the Prime Minister, because the Prime Minister went up to give this speech about being honest, being straightforward with the public, and in contrast, as he would put it, to Nigel Farage's fantasy economics. So then journalists, after the speech, started asking specific questions about any decision to give way on the two-child benefit cap. It is a bugbear of many Labour MPs. Indeed, seven Labour MPs lost the whip last summer when they voted for an SNP amendment to remove the cap. Keir Starmer was asked the question, having, of course, already, as you say, Fee, rode back on the winter fuel allowance three times. On the first two occasions, he just ignored it. He didn't answer it. And then it was picked up a third time.
You've dodged the question on the two-child benefit cap twice now. So can I ask you, as a first question, would you personally like to get rid of the two-child benefit cap? And on the wider issue of the opposition you're now facing, do you think one of the problems is that Nigel Farage can approximate talking like a human being, where you just resort to talking points and dodging questions?
Well, look, I mean, on the question of two-child benefit, my apologies. I think I did the first half of the question, not the second. Let me deal with that directly. I'm determined we're going to drive down child poverty. One of the proudest things that the last Labour government did was to drive down child poverty, and that's why we've got a task force working on this. I think there are a number of components. There isn't a single bullet, but I'm absolutely determined that we will drive this down, and that's why we'll look at all options, all ways of driving down child poverty. I'm determined. I'm so proud the last Labour government did it, and I'm so pleased that we are taking up that challenge to do it with this Labour government, and that's what we will do.
So no answer.
Yeah, what about the human thing? It just wasn't, he just didn't go back to
that. He didn't go back to that point, but he wouldn't give an answer on the two-child benefit cap. Of course, there's going to be a welfare, there's likely to be a significant rebellion on Labour's welfare reforms. They're sticking with the £5 billion cuts announced by Liz Candle earlier in the year. And of course, they're promising to ease in those cuts and potentially make some changes so that they don't bite as hard as many disability charities fear that they will. On the two-child benefit cap, of course, that costs around £3.5 billion. There'd been a lot of talk in the last week or so about them removing that cap, but they don't yet have a plan to exactly how to pay for it. This is coming up on June the 11th. There's a spending review. It's not a major fiscal event, a budget where you would, a government has the ability, unless they want to make it where they can impose tax changes. So therefore, at the moment, it's looking as if, certainly judging by that answer, Keir Starmer doesn't have a plan in place in order to remove the cap and release that money to some of the poorest children in the country.
And the human question, it had an edge to it. The tone of the question, was that slightly different to how journalists usually ask their questions?
Yes, I think it was, and it's quite unusual this early in a parliament for a prime minister. He's not even a year into office yet to face questions with quite such ferocity. There is obviously a huge amount of frustration on the Labour benches with the way that Keir Starmer's premiership has gone. But you saw John McDonnell, who of course has had the whip suspended as part of his rebellion when it came to the two-child benefit cap, saying that actually he thinks that Angela Rayner, the Deputy Prime Minister, would be a better leader of the Labour Party, and that Labour is at risk of not just destroying itself in government, but destroying itself as a party. So we're already approaching that territory where you start to see the early signs of the power that comes naturally with being Prime Minister and the office of Number 10 Downing Street ever so slightly being chipped away at.
Now, Nick is not going to be thrilled with our conversation over the next couple of minutes because he has said, Jenrick and Farage, how wonderful. Can't get enough of those two. Thanks so much. They won't get free airtime on their own, right? How come Reform have four MPs, but the Lib Dems have a dozen, but you never hear about the Lib Dems and hear every day about Reform or Farage? So we've done the Farage bit. Nick, you might want to just look away now. I mean, I suppose, you know, the obvious answer is because they are causing disruptions, and actually maybe we should just own it as journalists. We like a disruption.
So firstly, you have a situation now where Nigel Farage is dictating the government's policy and the way that in the direction of travel within. We saw this with the immigration white paper. Secondly, if you look at the polls, and this was borne out in the local elections results, there is now a distinct possibility that Nigel Farage will be Prime Minister. Ed Davey, who of course revealed on your programme a couple of weeks ago, Fee, would quite like the idea of being in power as part of a coalition. But nobody is suggesting at the moment, it's an impossibility at the moment for Ed Davey to become Prime Minister, whereas that is not the case for Nigel Farage. So I appreciate that that Nick might want to, I don't know, take his radio where there is no transmission for the next 2 minutes or
no,
so.
But no,
stay, but, stay but so us. So that he stays with us, but then maybe when he walks back in having potted some plants or whatever in the garden, then he, of course, he would hear the rest of the conversation. But yes.
Yeah, and good to hear from you, Nick. Thank you for being in touch in the first place. Let's consider what Robert Jenrick has been doing. He's been out and about this morning stopping fare dodgers on the London Underground. Shall we hear this magic? Here we go.
Excuse me, do you think it's all right not to pay? Seriously, why do you go back to the barrier and pay? Do you want to go back and pay like everybody else? Do you think it's all right not to pay? Why don't you go back and pay? You can off as much as you want. But everyone else has to pay. You're carrying a knife, you say? Nearly one in 25 people using London's public transport aren't paying for it. It's the same with bike theft, phone theft, tool theft, shoplifting, drugs in town centres, weird Turkish barber shops. It's all chipping away.
So that's not going to be the last time we see Robert Jenrick out and about doing his stuff. He wants to be the master of the new technology that takes him around the country and around the world in minutes.
2.6 million views I checked just before I came into the studio. That video has got, having been posted online this morning, of Robert Jenrick, the Shadow Justice Secretary, at Stratford Station accosting fare dodgers who had barged their way through the barriers at the underground station. And his argument is that that is much more effective. It gives him much more visibility than if he is to give a good speech on the floor of the House
and
of Commons.
And he's right, isn't he? I mean, he's just right about
that. He is right. And he's also, I think what's pertinent, and there are some comments in there which I think many listeners will find distasteful about the weird Turkish barber shops, and of course there's always been this is something that we've heard from Nigel Farage and from Reform as well, that they are used as a front for money laundering. And Robert Jenrick was saying there are also American sweet shops that he's worried about and vaping shops that are used as these fronts for criminality. But more personally, if you were to look at the success of this video and why it's done well, and Luke Trill, who I know is a regular on Times Radio from More in Common, has made the point that Robert Jenrick had very successfully tapped into this feeling of fairness that most people will pay to go through the barriers and then there are some that won't. This is what he told Hugo Rifkin.
I think this is a big issue, and I think it's a slap in the face to hardworking people, most people in our country who are going to work, going shopping, going to school or college, whatever it might be, and paying on public transport when they see other people just getting away with it.
Well, that was his contribution to Times Radio this morning. Theo, thank you very much indeed for that. We welcome all of your comments. It's 0333 003 2353.
Coming up, it is 21 minutes past two. Why is ham lending a new terror to early years, and should we really be worried? This is Fee Glover and Tom Whipple on Times Radio, sponsored by Solar with Hive. Find out why solar could be right for you at hivehome.com.
Alexis Conran on Times Radio. Trusted news, essential analysis and thought-provoking insight.
And we bring you issues that shape your world but you may have missed.
The news you need to know, the views you need to hear.
There is no way that that is acceptable in Parliament.
Telling the stories that matter.
There simply isn't enough data to assess the impact it will have.
Alexis Conran, Saturday and Sunday afternoon from 1 on Times Radio.
Don't go. No one knows instruments like you do.
A sales assistant at Jen's Music Store is moving up north. so she needs to find a replacement. A musical whiz who hits all the right notes.
I bet you're going to miss this peace and quiet.
Indeed can help her find great people fast.
I need Indeed.
Indeed you do. When you post a sponsored job, you get a list of candidates whose CVs on Indeed match your description. To start hiring, visit indeed.com/try today.
Time for a new Mercedes-Benz? Finding your perfect car is simpler than ever. And right now, there are offers across the range, like the A200 AMG Line Executive Hatchback from £349 a month with an advance rental of £6,907. Visit us at Mercedes-Benz. PCH offer ends 30th of June, 4-year lease. T's and C's apply. Mercedes-Benz Finance. Mercedes-Benz is a credit intermediary, not a lender. Commission paid. Speak to us for details.
This is the call of the Chiff Chaff. This is the call of the Willow Warbler. Hear the difference? Thankfully, some things are obvious, like choosing Interactive Investor for your ISA and personal pension. With 30 years' experience, over 430,000 customers, and a rating of excellent on Trustpilot, the choice is obvious. Search Interactive Investor. Investment values can go down as well as up. You could get back less than you invest.
Is call handling causing a headache for your business? MoneyPenny has the answer. MoneyPenny's telephone answering service blends brilliant people and AI technology to create the ultimate business PA, saving you time, money, and hassle. Your business and your customers deserve the UK's best service. Unrivaled telephone answering from MoneyPenny. Find out more at moneypenny.com.
With Wild Frontiers, you'll see more with those who know the way. Experience nomadic culture on a journey along the Silk Road. Watch the sun rise over the ruins of Tikal in Guatemala. Or learn the secrets of Japanese cuisine in Kyoto. On a Wild Frontiers adventure, you'll have the freedom to take it all in, to never stop seeking. Visit wildfrontierstravel.com for expertly crafted tours that take you further.
Visit Times Radio on YouTube for the latest videos and interviews.
Weekday afternoons on Times Radio, sponsored by Solar with Hive. Find out why Solar could be right for you at hivehome.com. Hive, know your power.
Schools are being told that they should stop putting foods like sausage rolls and ham sandwiches on the menu. It's because they increase the risk of diseases like cancer. A report from the charity The Food Foundation suggests that more than a third of meat eaten by children is processed or ultra-processed, such as ham, sausages and chicken nuggets. Rebecca Toby is from The Food Foundation. She joins us now. Rebecca, tell us more about this report.
Thanks. So what we did is we've analysed National Diet and Nutrition Survey data to really try and understand what type of meat are we eating in the UK and where are we eating it. And what we found is that, well, firstly, we're eating a lot of meat. So the UK eats twice as much meat as the global average. But I think what was most concerning to us was just how much processed meat children are eating. So 36% of all the meat that children are eating is processed. And that's concerning because there is a very, very strong body of evidence that suggests, you know, processed meat has a number of negative health outcomes. So it's a health risk. And yet children are eating a lot of meat, and that's, you know, processed meat. And that's despite both the NHS and the government's healthy eating guidelines recommending we actually eat less red and processed meat. We also looked at where children are eating meat. And what we found is that actually of the of the three of the five most commonly eaten meat dishes that are eaten in schools or other educational kind of institutional settings are processed meat. So you've got ham, sausages, sausage rolls. These are all very commonly eaten and served in that school environment. And that's concerning because it's a health risk. But to be honest, it's also a wasted and missed opportunity because done right, you know, school food can play a really critical role in providing children with the nourishment they need to grow, learn and thrive.
This feels it feels like we've been talking about this for quite some time. It feels a bit sort of turkey twizzlers all over again. If people have been saying these things, you know, that healthy school meals is the place to instill good eating habits. Why hasn't it happened?
I mean, I think there's a number of reasons for that. I mean, I think, you know, we have good, fairly good school food standards. I mean, I think there's more that can be done specifically around some of the requirements in there about serving meat. So at the minute, there's a requirement that meat serve, schools serve meat three times a week. We think that should be relaxed and stronger guidance given around processed meat that's served. But I think there's also an issue with compliance and actually monitoring whether the standards are being met, because all too often they're just not. And I think, you know, another thing we've seen over recent years, you know, is the cost of living crisis. And, you know, a lot of school caterers have had to be, you know, very, very on the price. And, you know, what happens when you're trying to cut costs? Often that means, you know, you end up with kind of certainly in respect to meat, kind of cheaper processed meat options.
The Turkey Twizzler generation, going back to that, they're now sort of adults, and I work with some of them, and they say they really liked Turkey Twizzlers. I mean, you know, what point are these? Is the health risk really so bad that this should be a priority?
I mean, I think it's stark. You know, when you look at processed meat, the World Health Organization classifies it as a class one carcinogen. You know, Cancer Research UK says that, you know, if you're looking at bowel cancer cases across the UK, 13% of those just in 1 year are caused by eating processed meat. So, you know, this is a health risk that I think everybody is agreed is a risk. And yet we're sort of swimming in these food environments where processed meat is just everywhere. And that makes it very hard for families who actually want different options, healthier options, to actually be able to provide, you know, their children with kind of healthy, available and affordable options.
Given the constraints on schools and given the current political environment, what is it you would like to see done, and how feasible do you think it would be?
Well, I mean, I think it's feasible in respect that we know the government, you know, that they were elected on a manifesto to raise the healthiest generation of children ever. So, you know, that is kind of baked into the platform that this government was elected on. I think, you know, on a practical level, what we'd like to see happening is for the government procurement rules to be strengthened with a review of those kind of buying standards, so that sort of nutritious food is really, you know, served kind of everywhere, and a real focus of those standards. And with the school food standards, you know, we'd like that requirement to serve meat three times a week to be relaxed, and also have sort of specific guidance around, you know, the amount of processed meat being served.
Rebecca, do you think one of the problems, and this happens across government, is that it seems to be almost impossible for the government to be able to give us coherent statistics about how much money would be saved further down the line if we actually spent a bit of money at the beginning of the line? If you give children better food and a better palate and a better education about what they're eating when they're small, I mean, it just must stand to reason that you save that same taxpayer a fortune further down the line. Why can't we know more about that?
I mean, absolutely, as you say, it's an investment in children's future, isn't it? But it's also an investment in our NHS. You know, at the minute, you know, you have an NHS that's buckling under the strain of many diet-related diseases, you know, type 2 diabetes, heart disease, etc. You know, diet plays a role in all of those diseases. You know, I think there is a lot of modelling out there, for example, on free school meals, of the kind of economic benefits, you know, for every £1 spent on free school meals, you know, what kind of actual value that generates. I think, you know, with all these things, it's hard to get these kind of issues up the agenda, and we just haven't sort of seen that coherent food strategy or that real focus on children's food that I think many of us would like to see.
Thank you very much. That's Rebecca Toby from the Food Foundation.
You're listening to Times Radio. It's Fee Glover and Tom Whipple with you this afternoon. Thousands of Russian troops amassed to Ukraine's north. Is a renewed invasion imminent? That is the story that we will go to next after a checkup on the latest news headlines with Andy Hayes.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Thank you, Fee. Good afternoon. The Prime Minister has claimed it would be Liz Truss all over again if voters were to support Reform UK's economic policies. Sir Keir Starmer claims that just like the former Tory PM, Nigel Farage is making promises he can't keep.
We're once again fighting the same fantasy that you can spend tens of billions of pounds on tax cuts without a proper way of paying for it, using your family finances as the gambling chip on his mad experiment.
Farage says he would reinstate winter fuel payments and drop the two-child benefit cap. He would also scrap net zero and public sector diversity initiatives. Police say a nine-year-old child was among those injured when a car drove into people at Liverpool FC's title parade on Monday. Officers say the victims' ages range from 9 to 78. All are understood to be British. Police have until this evening to question a 53-year-old man from West Derby in Liverpool on suspicion of attempted murder, dangerous driving and drug driving. It's understood Donald Trump will appeal a US court's decision to block his global tariffs. A three-judge panel has concluded the president exceeded his authority when announcing further taxes on foreign-made goods. The Environment Agency is urging people in the northwest of England to be mindful about the amount of water they're using. A drought has officially been declared in the region. And a sausage roll, a very special sausage roll, is going on display. Greggs has announced that a waxwork figure of its baked treat will be under the spotlight at Madame Tussauds in London. It coincides with National Sausage Roll Day, which is on the 5th of June. And for a roundup of the news on demand, subscribe to the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
Don't go. No one knows instruments like you do.
A sales assistant at Jen's music store is moving up north, so she needs to find a replacement. A musical whiz who hits all the right notes.
I bet you're going to miss this peace and quiet.
Indeed can help her find great people fast.
I need Indeed.
Indeed you do. When you post a sponsored job, you get a list of candidates whose CVs on Indeed match your description. To start hiring, visit Indeed.com/try today.
Get the big sporting news stories with Kate Borsay, Monday to Thursday at 9:45 p.m.
Weekday afternoons on Times Radio, sponsored by Solar with Hive. Find out how you can harness the power of solar at hivehome.com.
Nick, thank you for your messages. Nick is going to stop sending us messages and go and have a lie down in the dark. But don't go away and lie down for too long. And you may want to stay listening because Tom Whipple has got some anecdotes that I might force him to tell later, which have been published already.
They have been published. Okay, yes, yeah. Yeah, they have.
No, don't worry, I'm not going to do the unpublished ones, but we might manage to squeeze those in between now and 4 o'clock about Bobby J.
Yeah.
So come back to us, Nick. Don't go forever. That's all I'm saying.
But first, we are here with John Pienaar. What have you got coming up?
So the judgment of the federal court, basically knocking wheels off Donald Trump's wagon of tariffs, global tariffs, it landed like a bombshell, you know, while we were sleeping, pretty much. I sort of woke up at about 2 o'clock in the morning and just thought for a moment, what's tomorrow going to be like? And looked at my phone the way that I do, but shouldn't. And there it was. I mean, the whole thing had gone not quite kaput, but the whole thing is in question, which is curious because the authority, the legal basis of this was in question from the beginning. The ability of the president to say, I'm going to do this, not Congress, which is not what the Constitution says, and that this is all about a national emergency, which, of course, it really isn't. It's just a convenient way of doing it. But what now is the massive question. And the short answer is I've no idea, and nor does anybody else. But we're going to talk about it. And I'm going to be talking to lawyers, to market investment experts. I'm going to be talking to Erwin Stelzer, the respected economist and writer, and just get their take of all this. So if we can't answer the question, what next, we can at least get some sort of clue on what we should be thinking about. I've got on Brian Lord. He's the former Deputy Director of Intelligence and Cyber Operations at GCHQ to talk about the Britain ramping up as part of the defence review, our cyber defences, which is interesting because the number of times we've done stories about us being attacked, you know, by people either for or working with China or Russia and various other baddies, and nothing much about what we do in exchange, if anything. Well, we could talk about that because that now seems to be part of the plan.
We are obsessed on our podcast about prepping for a massive cyber attack.
Are you?
Yes. So we've been advising people because Jane's been prepping for years.
How do you prep for a cyber attack?
Oh, my goodness. Well, just in case everything completely and utterly goes down.
Oh, you mean stacking up on corned beef in the cellar?
Yeah, stacking up on everything. But also just reminding yourself of how you lived before everything was connected in a cyber way. So you've got to put those connections back
together. Except all of the things that we needed to live back then are also connected in a cyber way. So, you know, the national grid goes down if it's cyber attacks. I spoke to some guys at GCHQ about this, and they felt there's this idea that they alluded to this idea because they wouldn't be so indiscreet, that almost everyone's got these things waiting in each other's systems, ready to go, and it's sort of one and done, mutually assured destruction, a bit like nuclear weapons, but for the...
I'm not sure you can even stack up on corned beef and bottled water, actually, because you probably need to tap into some system to order it, and wherever you get it from needs to tap into a system to stock up on it.
So, well, Ocado, maybe I'm lost hopeless. Without Ocado, so yeah. That's...
I'm lost without Ocado. You're with Times Radio, everybody. It'll be good. It'll be good news. For
Waitrose
you.
Also exists.
Be good news, John, because then you won't be able to look at your phone at 2 a.m. and read stories. I'm worried for you, man.
Yeah.
You can't be doing that. How do you get back to sleep?
Sometimes I don't feel.
Oh, John.
Yeah. Lord, but that's a bit of product of my twisted body clock, rather than just bad habit. Maybe I should try. I don't know. Cocoa.
I was really, really, really worried for a nanosecond there, but cocoa is good. Oh, my word. It's 2:38. Russia now has enough troops to Ukraine's north to mount a renewed invasion near the city of Sumy. That is according to Ukrainian border guards and comes after repeated warnings about a build-up of Russian forces. Meanwhile, Donald Trump has given Vladimir Putin 2 weeks to prove he's serious about ending the fighting.
We're going to find out whether or not he's tapping us along or not. And if he is, we'll respond a little bit differently. But it'll take about a week and a half, 2 weeks. We have Mr. Witkoff is here, is doing a phenomenal job, is dealing with them very strongly right now. They seem to want to do something, but until the document is signed, I can't tell you. Nobody can. I'm very disappointed at what happened a couple of nights now where people were killed in the middle of what you would call a negotiation. I'm very disappointed by that.
Donald Trump there addressing recent massive air attacks on Ukraine towards the end of his answer. So let's talk about that with Dr. Hannah Schelest, a security studies specialist who's advised on Ukraine's naval and foreign policy strategy. Dr. Schelest, you're very welcome on the programme. Thank you for making the time for us. Can we just talk about the city of Sumy? What's the strategic significance?
Thank you for the invitation. Sumy is one of the regional centers of Ukraine, and it is just at the border with the Kursk region. And you can imagine that the Russians originally wanted to occupy or at least to enter that territory a year ago. And that was the reason why Ukrainian armed forces needed to cross to the Russian territory and occupy some parts of the Kursk region, something that we've been talking a lot last year. One of the reasons for this was exactly not to allow Russians to occupy or at least to try to occupy yet one Ukrainian region. As for now, we still have some of the forces in Kharkiv region, just at the border. Sumy would be another one, and everything is closer and closer to Kyiv. So not allowing them to do it, it's just a matter of security.
Okay, 50,000 troops as well. Can you put that into perspective for us?
It depends for what do you need it and how effective they are, because here the question is not in numbers. For example, you can compare it to the Russian losses per day, and usually it is 1,000. So it is 50 days of the Russian losses in their war in Ukraine. At the same time, 50,000 is quite an important and big amount. It's not the diversant group, and that would need Ukraine to take some of our forces, either from the south or from the east, to protect the northern border. So in this case, definitely, that's a significant amount, because you need, for example, not one brigade, but much bigger forces to be moved from other territories where the significant fightings are happening. So as the threat, that's significant. But at the same time, is it enough to occupy the new region? No, it's definitely not. And the operations like Bakhmut or Pokrovsk clearly demonstrated that it is three times less than what Russia may need for the initial attack.
You mentioned there 1,000 troops a day losing their lives, well, being killed. That's a better way of putting it, isn't it? I mean, sometimes we do need to really stop, don't we, and make sure that we are thinking about that intense loss of life, thinking about the families left behind, thinking about the amount of grief involved on both sides. When you hear President Trump try to do that, and he does try to do that, Do you believe his sincerity?
I believe his sincerity, but I would go a little bit earlier in your phrase about the grief from that side. Most of those who are currently from the Russian side, they made this decision by themselves. Many of them just signed the contract because they were ready for money, for the salary or for the compensation that they would receive from the Russian government to kill civilian Ukrainians or to occupy the territory of another state. So here I would say that in the statement of Mr. Trump, there is one big problem. Then when he compare the invader, those who are making intentionally the decision to kill others and to die because they're joining the armed forces, they are not joining the kindergarten, and the civilian Ukrainians from another side who never wanted to attack Russia, who never wanted this war. So in this way, probably to make in the same quotation, the invader and the victim would be just injustice for all those who are in Bucha, sure, in Irpin, and in plenty of other cities.
Sure, and Dr. Schlesser, I really hear you on that. What's the total loss of life, though, since the Russian invasion?
We still don't know, and that is the biggest problem, because we don't know information from the occupied territories. For example, the city of Mariupol that's been heavily bombed, and we see just with the satellite aerial how many of the new graves appeared, for example, around the city. And the estimation of the human rights organization was about several hundred thousand people only in one city when the fighting began 2 years ago there. So what to speak about the other territories that are also under the total occupation, and we just don't have the proper information from there.
This two-week warning that President Trump has given to Vladimir Putin, what do you think will happen during those 2 weeks?
We already had these 2 weeks, so honestly, I don't know what would be, because originally the US president said about 2 weeks in the end of April. We are already in the end of May, and he's speaking again about the 2 weeks. So that's reminded me the old phrase about the League of Nations, the organization that was before the United Nations, that what the League of Nations can do, they will send the telegram to the conflicting parties asking them to stop. After the 10th telegram, they will say that, okay, that is our last telegram and we will not send you anymore. And here I'm afraid that I already heard about 3 days, 24 hours, 1 month, 100 days, 2 weeks. And Russia is just using these. They are just dragging time. And even to present their memorandum with conditions for the ceasefire took them 3 weeks. And we don't know will it be presented on Monday or not. They just understood and they played the tricks with Americans that as soon as they speak that they are ready for the negotiations, Americans will wait. So yet 2 weeks after them, most probably will be additional weeks.
And what have you made of the language that has bounced between Putin and Trump? Trump calling Putin crazy. Those kind of, unhelpful big headlines that actually seem to divert the world's attention away from what Ukraine wants to happen and wants to be heard said.
Let's say that we all knew what has been Donald Trump and his social network. So it seems to me that nobody really surprised by the type of the language that he's using there. So originally, and still in the social networks, yes, it's making a news, but it's not the news for the experts or for the diplomats, for the politicians. We see what is the Russian reaction as we are following their social networks or their politicians, and they are just laughing. Unfortunately, they are not taking it seriously. So it doesn't have the effect that the American president wanted it to have. Russians are expecting actions, not the tweets or something like this. In this way, it's just like, you know, as any other meme that is appearing in the social networks. What is much more important is what conditions the U.S. delegation is presenting to Ukrainians or to Russians, what sanctions they are ready to apply, and do they deliver weapons or not? So the actions are much more important than the tweets.
Yeah, for sure. Just to return to Sumy, the residents of Sumy, most of them have been evacuated. Am I right to say that?
Not from the city of Sumy. We are speaking about the villages around Sumy. The Sumy city is not evacuated yet. However, definitely a lot of people have been leaving the city because for several months, Russians have been using so-called gliding bombs. It's very difficult to intercept them. Because it is so close to the border, so Russian airplanes are not crossing the border. They are in the safe airspace at their territory. And then they are sending these bombs, just destroying the town. It's still not that dangerous as, for example, situation was in Bakhmut or what is happening in the cities like Konstantinovka on the east, but definitely it is the daily attacks and that make the situation quite complicated and dangerous.
It's really good to talk to you this afternoon. Thank you very much indeed for that. That's Dr. Hannah Schelest, who is a securities study specialist who has advised on Ukraine's naval and foreign policy strategy.
Coming up, it is 12 minutes to three. Now, in the fields of East Anglia, there are some exciting potatoes. And if that won't keep you listening, I don't know what will. Hear about the potatoes after the break. This is Fee Glover and Tom Whipple on Times Radio, sponsored by Solar with Hive. Find out how you can make the switch to solar simple and easy at hivehome.com.
Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide. Start your day with Times Radio's essential morning briefing, with intelligent conversation and incisive analysis from some of the most respected names in politics, culture and entertainment. Hear well-informed opinion and quality journalism on all the big stories making the headlines. Times Radio Breakfast. Tomorrow morning from 6 with Nationwide. A good way to bank.
Listen to Times Radio on your DAB digital radio.
Yes, that price includes more technical support.
Oh dear, the buy now button on each page isn't clickable.
Layla's web development agency will soon have more clients than they can handle. To avoid a code red, she needs new programmers.
Okay, I've just tweaked the code, so everything should be fine now.
Indeed can help her find great people fast.
I need Indeed.
Indeed you do. Because Indeed's hiring platform makes finding great talent easy. To start hiring, visit Indeed.com/try today.
Sail through the heart of historic cities and unforgettable scenery with Viking. Unpack once and get closer to iconic landmarks, local life, and cultural treasures. Because when you experience Europe on a Viking longship, you'll spend less time getting there and more time being there. Learn more at Viking.com. Viking, exploring the world in comfort.
Time for a new Mercedes-Benz? Finding your perfect car is simpler than ever. And right now, there are offers across the range, like the A200 AMG Line Executive Hatchback from £349 a month with an advance rental of £6,907. Visit us at Mercedes-Benz. PCH offering 30th of June, 4-year lease. T's and C's apply. Mercedes-Benz Finance. Mercedes-Benz is a credit intermediary, not a lender. Commission paid. Speak to us for details.
This is Times Radio.
Now, they say in radio presenter school that you should imagine that you're talking to just one person. And today I feel like I am, because Nick is back. He's very intrigued by the fact that we're going to be talking potatoes. And it was a lovely trail ahead of the hard quarterways, as we like to call them in the world of radio. We're talking potatoes with Tom Whipple. But also, we have promised Nick a fantastic anecdote about your time at university with a very esteemed politician.
Yeah, it's always a moment of sadness when one of your contemporaries does well in life. And I suppose Robert Jenrick is now the most read story on the Times website, so he has done well in life. We were at university together. We didn't know each other, but I knew of him. He ran, his political career began when he ran for JCR president at, I think, John's College in Cambridge. And he ran unopposed, but there was a campaign within the college for RON, which stands for Reopen Nominations. And the campaign reached a pitch where, as I understand it, whenever Jenrick turned up in the college bar, people would sing, da-do Ron, 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 da-do Ron, Ron. Anyway, he lost to Ron, and he lost the unopposed election to be JCR president. And there was another round, and alas, he lost that as well. So a lot like the Tory leadership.
OK. Okay. That's quite something, isn't it? That is quite something.
It is. I mean, no, students can be cruel as well. Maybe they didn't want a member of the Young Tories, as I presume he might have been, to be the JCR president. But anyway, he's back now and he's accosting people on escalators. And where am I? I'm sitting down talking into a microphone.
Well, you've done very well for yourself as well. I feel that I do need to shoehorn that in there because you must... There must be lots of people who look at where you've got to and think, I wish that I'd done as well as that.
Well, there's Wes Streeting was one of my contemporaries as well.
Well, and, he's always saying that, Tom Whipple. Boy, he's got the dream job that I want.
Is that why he ignored my last message?
He gets to talk potatoes on the radio. I'm here sorting out the National Health Service. Right, it is time for spuds.
Shall we talk potatoes?
Please talk potatoes.
In a field in East Anglia today, there is a large greenhouse worth of potato plants being put in the soil, possibly even as we speak. I've seen a picture of them. They are big, they are bushy, they are green. That being the leaves, obviously the potatoes themselves might be a bit green, but they're going to not be green. But these are not just any potatoes. They are, as we trailed, extremely exciting potatoes because thanks to genetic technology, they are, we hope, resistant to disease. The time was they would have been at risk, though, of destruction by activists labelled as Franken potatoes. But I'm joined by Jonathan Jones from the Sainsbury Laboratory, and perhaps our attitude to these sorts of foods is changing. Jonathan, tell me about your Franken potatoes. What makes them so special?
Well, thank you for getting on. And I was a contemporary of Michael Portillo. So here am I coming up with better potatoes and he's telling people about railways. I have been working for many a year on how to understand the way in which plants' immune system enables them to resist disease. Currently, potatoes have to be sprayed 15 times a year or so to control a disease called late blight, which was the biotic cause of the Irish potato famine in the 1840s and still causes upwards of $5 billion a year of losses in potato production. And we've identified immune receptors in wild relatives of potato that we can put into potato and can basically create an upgrade that has added resistance.
Will I ever be able to eat these potatoes?
I certainly hope so. So thanks to the joys of, or otherwise, depending on your point of view, of Brexit, the tiny silver lining around that cloud is the capacity to set our own rules on methods for improving our crops. And so we can escape from really the very incompetent or excessive level of regulation that you find in the EU of these improvement methods and deploy them to reduce the environmental impact of agriculture by reducing the amount of chemicals that need to be sprayed to control diseases in our crops.
And look, we've had a period when we haven't been able to grow these commercially, and as you say, that might be changing. But the reason we haven't is that 30 years ago, people were extremely worried about these crops. They painted people like you as boffins doing jiggery-pokery to nature. Why isn't that still a concern? And is that a concern, or was it ever a concern?
You use the term people there. I would replace it with the term activists. There were people who were thoroughly opposed to the technology, and it was actually a lightning rod for opposition to a whole way of conducting agriculture. The regulations put in place at that time in the 90s were put in place, to use a phrase from before when Donald Rumsfeld was invented, people thought there might be unknown unknowns they didn't even know they didn't know about. And that's a very poor way to regulate. Another term for that way of regulating is the precautionary principle. The problem with the precautionary principle is it needs to have a reverse gear, or it needs to be time limited, because it's predicated on the assumption that you don't know whether or not something is completely safe, so you make cautious regulations. And what you need to do is enable those to be adjusted when more knowledge comes to light. And so it's very clear now that the methods that we're talking about are benign, safe and useful and should be deployed to reduce the environmental impact of agriculture. Now, what happened in the 90s is a matter of debate, but I would point out that when one of the first products that came to consumers was put on supermarket shelves, it was the Zeneca tomato paste where the tomatoes have been adjusted to make their ripening slower and they're going soft slower. And this was labelled, and it was really uncontroversial, and millions of tins of this were sold. What provoked community outrage, I think, is that large shipments of soybeans came in from the US for animal feed that had been improved with these methods. And there was no labelling, there was no capacity for consumers to say thanks but no thanks. And I think consumer choice creates a lot of annoyance, or lack of consumer choice creates a lot of annoyance. And so I certainly hope that the potatoes we come up with will be have labels on the bags like proudly protected from disease with biology, not chemistry.
And why should we be messing about with natural potatoes? Because this is what it comes down to. A lot of people's objections, they just find it quite icky, and the idea that scientists are going into the stuff of life and fiddling about with it.
I'm going to challenge another word that you use there, which is natural potatoes. So these potatoes are very different from the wild ancestors, in the same way as all of the other crops we grow are very different from their wild ancestors, whether it's wheat, maize, tomatoes, etc. So these have all been actually modified by genetics, even though as a geneticist, to my mind, that is genetic modification, although I know that's not the way in which the term is usually used. So there's no uniform type of wheat. Wheat carries genes brought in from, many wild grasses. And the same is true of potatoes. We cross our potatoes in breeding programs with wild relatives to bring in genes that confer useful traits. We have done for millennia, and certainly quite intensively over the last many decades. So the varieties that are planted are not, in inverted commas, natural. They are man-made, or at least person-adjusted.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Jonathan Jones from the Sainsbury Laboratory. I do hope we get to make chips out of your potatoes sometime soon.
Right, there's a backlash against the Oxbridge contingent.
There is.
Yep, and I'm part of it. University of Kent at Canterbury. I'm going to have to look up anyone I was at university with, Tom. And Kate, thank goodness you're listening too. More to come from the both of us.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
It's 3 o'clock. You're listening to Fee Glover and Tom Whipple on Times Radio.
Coming up in the next hour of the programme, fear and loathing in Washington, D.C. Donald Trump's tariff policy ruled unlawful. What is next from the White House? Your money or your life? We've got an update on the modern-day highwaymen holding up cryptocurrency millionaires. Tom's big interview is with the biologist Richard Dawkins, and we'll peek into the pages of the Times magazine and tell you what you can look forward to.
But that's all coming after the news with Andy Hayes.
Thank you, Tom. Good afternoon. The Prime Minister has claimed it would be Liz Truss all over again if voters were to support Reform UK's economic policies. Sir Keir Starmer claims that just like the former Tory PM, Reform leader Nigel Farage is making promises he can't keep. Reform says it would reinstate winter fuel payments and drop the two-child benefit cap. But its chairman, Zia Yusuf, says the UK's budget would be cut to pay for those measures.
Nigel has laid out how we're going to save between £300 and £400 billion from the exchequer spending as a result of decisions he will make. And by the way, those decisions are going to improve the lives of British people. Let's take net zero, because it's actually really important. We think we'll save £40 to £45 billion a year as a result of this insane net zero religion.
Sir Keir Starmer has hinted he could give ground on the two-child benefit cap, saying he's determined to drive down child poverty. Police say a 9-year-old child was among those injured when a car drove into people at Liverpool FC's title parade on Monday. Officers say the victims' ages range from 9 to 78. All are understood to be British. Police have until this evening to question a 53-year-old man from West Derby in Liverpool on suspicion of attempted murder, dangerous driving and drug driving. It's understood Donald Trump will appeal a US court's decision to block his global tariffs. A 3-judge panel has concluded the president exceeded his authority when announcing further taxes on foreign-made goods. Robert Jenrick, the Shadow Justice Secretary, has confronted fare dodgers on the London Underground. He claims law-breaking is out of control in the capital. He's been to Stratford Station in East London.
Do you think it's all right not to pay? Seriously, why do you go back through the barrier and pay? Do you want to go back and pay like everybody else? Do you think it's all right not to pay? Why don't you go back and pay? You can off as much as you want.
Transport for London says about one in every 25 passengers is not paying, but Jenrick has told Times Radio he fears it's a lot more serious than that.
From an hour or so at Stratford Tube, it was way higher than that because we saw people every couple of minutes going through the barriers, complete impunity, no one worried at all to do it. And there's a YouGov survey that shows that across the country, this is a much bigger issue than just London, across the country, almost 80% of people have seen people fare dodging on public transport.
More than 800,000 people in England have been formally diagnosed with ADHD, according to new NHS data. It's the first time the health service has released figures following a surge in demand for treatment over the last 5 years. The number of people being prescribed medication on the NHS for ADHD has tripled over the last decade. The British Medical Association has told Times Radio that the government has betrayed doctors by not working to restore pay to 2008 levels. But the health secretary is warning medics have lost the support of the public and would choke the NHS by holding more strikes. And the Environment Agency is urging people in the northwest of England to be mindful about the amount of water they are using. A drought has officially been declared in the region. And for a roundup of the news on demand, find the Times News briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker.
Weekday afternoons on Times Radio, sponsored by Solar with Hive.
And now to the carousel of chaos at the White House. Donald Trump's administration is appealing a ruling that found his tariff policy to be unlawful. Reactions to that ruling have varied. One advisor labelled the judgment a judicial coup, while stock markets worldwide have rallied a bit in the aftermath. Daniel Lipman is a White House and Washington reporter for Politico. Daniel, what's the rationale behind this ruling?
So the rationale is that Trump exceeded his authority by using this decades-old law. It's called IEEPA. It's about international economic powers of the president, and that he didn't have enough justification and power in his authority to actually do these tariffs, that Congress actually has the power to do that, to put these tariff limits on, and that he exceeded that, and Congress could not just delegate the power because they've kind of been a wallflower in recent months, that they had to actually set the tariff rates, and they did not give Trump the authority on that.
And so the power that Trump's tried to use to impose tariffs without Congress, is all sort of emergency economic powers, is it?
Yeah, that it's if there is some type of true emergency that you can use those types of powers, but a trade deficit with the world that we've had for many years, that is not that's not a true emergency. And so I think, you know, this ruling got appealed immediately within a few minutes, and it'll probably go all the way to the Supreme Court, which is likely to say that this court was right. You know, this court is actually made up of one Trump judge and two other judges, but it was not three liberal judges who were just making this out of left field. This is a court that is has trade experts, and all they do is international trade.
Why does this? I mean, it seems to have come as a surprise to a lot of people, but it sounds like quite a reasonable means of appealing the tariffs. Why do you think people are surprised?
I think people did not realize that that there was this case brewing. I always kind of thought that courts would strike this down because I had talked to lawyers, I had talked to business groups who were really relying on this court to do their dirty work almost, and that for businesses that were going to lose their means to operate because they would have to raise prices, that they are not going to take that line down. And so they were bringing the Trump administration to court to argue that this is unfair and that he can't just impose it on his will. He's not a king. And so he's trying to kind of battle against that perception.
And in the White House itself, is there any reaction or sort of annoyance to the fact that the market's reaction to their policy being overturned appears to have been positive? How would they respond to that?
So Trump has reversed himself on tariffs numerous times. And so he may view this as a almost an excuse where he says, oh, I can't do more tariffs in this certain way. This doesn't mean he can't do tariffs on semiconductors or cars. That's a separate, or steel or aluminum. That's a separate law that he has been using and that presidents of both parties have used in the past. And so that is not going against precedent. But in terms of these reciprocal tariffs, these across-the-board tariffs, he could kind of blame the court and say, hey, my hands are tied, so I can't do all of these different tariffs. But the problem is he is going to probably try to use another law and see if he can get tariffs through that. And then I'm sure there'll be another court battle to see if he exceeds that. But I don't think we're going to see another Liberation Day anytime soon. But this does deprive him of a lot of negotiating leverage with foreign countries because he really wanted to make a lot of deals, which would have kind of given him lots of good press coverage.
And for other countries trying to negotiate with him, I think one of the telling things last night, he was asked about this concept that markets are trading on the basis of taco. Trump always chickens out. How did he react to that?
He called the reporter who asked him about this a nasty journalist who should never have asked that question. So it really touched the nerve. And he was pretty sensitive on that topic because he probably knows that it's true where if the market is going to totally tank and we're going to not be able to sell our debt on the bond markets, he is going to recognize the reality of that situation. He's not going to tank the economy fully. And so I think that he would hope that the taco trade goes away. And they don't bring it back for next Tuesday, Taco Tuesday. I don't think they want to have that. That's not food that's served in the state dining room in the White House.
Well, maybe it will be. I mean, if you put yourself in the shoes of a trade negotiator, maybe from a small island European nation, trying to work out on what basis they can negotiate terms with Trump and how serious his threats are and whether taco holds and whether courts will overturn things. Where do you go with this? Are we all just in his world now of uncertainty?
Well, as long as you don't have penguins, then you'll be okay. Remember how they
the herd island,
an island with lots of penguins. So the penguins have no idea that who Donald Trump is or what tariffs are. But no, I think that this gives those trade negotiators for countries across the world a reason not to bring lots of concessions because they know that it's almost like a poker game. If you don't think if you know that the other side, the counterparty, doesn't have a great hand of cards, then why should you, sorry for the loud noise, but why should you give in to what Trump is asking for? And so it's going to make for much tougher negotiations, and it's going to make Trump give more concessions to foreign countries in the spirit of getting a deal. The issue is, Trump doesn't really care about the details of these deals as much. The one with the UK is not even a full deal. It was just an outline. And we'll see if it's still, if it's null and void because of these tariffs or if it continues.
Well, I hope that truck behind you keeps on with its reversing and makes it wherever it needs to go. But before you go, we can't forget Elon Musk. And he says he's left the White House. How permanent is that and what does it mean?
Well, I don't think he's coming back. And so Doge continues, but this comes as Elon Musk criticized the big, beautiful bill that Trump has been touting that passed the House, saying it doesn't do anything to actually do those cuts that Doge wanted. It just actually adds to the deficit and has lots of spending. And so Trump probably was not thrilled when one of his top supporters was criticizing this bill that is the centerpiece of his domestic agenda. But I think Elon Musk is going back to his companies trying to save his reputation among liberals so that they can buy those Tesla cars.
And finally, does that mean that his influence inside the White House is waning or has waned?
Oh, it's waned for months. And so there was an initial spurt of publicity and power, and then the cabinet members and Trump kind of took back the power from Musk. And so now he's it'll be very rare that Musk will come back to the White House. And so this was kind of we all knew the bromance was not going to last forever.
Thank you very much. That's Daniel Lipman, who is White House and Washington reporter for Politico. No.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was just having a talkback conversation. We were just checking something out about Robert Jenrick. Yes, Ed Campbell, who is a special correspondent for joe.co.uk politics, Joe, has tweeted, I think, the tweet of the day so far, saying Robert Jenrick just marched into my flat and logged me out of my girlfriend's Netflix. So he's doing it just one injustice at a time.
Well, he is the hero we need, even if he's not the hero we seek.
Well, that is the kind of profound thing that you learn at a very top-notch university, if I may say so, Sir Tom Whipple. You're listening to Tom and Fee here on Times Radio this afternoon for one afternoon only, although I think for some future afternoons as well. Because
I am going to be each of you alternately, and then for a week I will be you combined as one, a beautiful melding of Fee and Jane, Fane, Whipple.
Oh, good God.
Or G.
Well, I hope that Ryan, who is superb at putting a soundtrack to everything, remembers to play When Two Becomes One as the opening to that particular afternoon show. I'll be listening. Right, we've got an update on the story of the crypto kidnappers that we brought you yesterday. You may remember that we talked to the reporter who was alerting us to these horrendous kind of modern day highwayman attacks on people who have bragged about how much cryptocurrency they have. They can be violent. They are certainly sinister and threatening. In one of those incidences over in France, one of the victims had a finger chopped off. It is really terrifying stuff. And we wanted to investigate the story a little bit more and talk about the legal precautions that can be taken in order to protect that cryptocurrency. You're listening to Times Radio. The afternoon show is sponsored by Solar with Hive. Find out why solar could be right for you at hivehome.com.
Stay connected to intelligent conversation and the latest breaking news wherever you are with the free Times Radio app. Listen in your car easily with Apple CarPlay and Android Auto options. And listen at home via Google Cast or on Apple AirPlay-enabled speakers and televisions. Plus, get instant access to a wide range of podcasts, including The Story and Off Air with Jane and Fee. Download the free Times Radio app by searching for Times Radio on the App Store or Google Play today.
Time for a new Mercedes-Benz? Finding your perfect car is simpler than ever. And right now, there are offers across the range, like the A200 AMG Line Executive Hatchback from £349 a month with an advance rental of £6,907. Visit us at Mercedes-Benz. PCH offer ends 30th of June, 4-year lease. T's and C's apply. Mercedes-Benz Finance. Mercedes-Benz is a credit intermediary, not a lender. Commission paid. Speak to us for details.
This is the sound of a forehand shot. And this is the sound of a backhand shot. Hear the difference? Thankfully, some things are obvious. Like choosing Interactive Investor for your personal pension. As a Which-recommended SIP provider, with a low flat fee, and a wide choice of investment options, the choice is obvious.
Advantage Wendy!
Woo-hoo! Search Interactive Investor Personal Pension. SIP values can fluctuate, and you could get back less than you invest.
At Viking, we believe travel should be more than just a trip. It should be a doorway to cultural insight and personal enrichment. Start planning your river, ocean, or expedition journey today and discover why Viking was named Best River Cruise Operator and Best Luxury Ocean Cruise Operator at the 2024 Times and Sunday Times Travel Awards. Learn more at viking.com.
Is call handling causing a headache for your business? Moneypenny has the answer.
MoneyPenny's telephone answering service blends brilliant people and AI technology to create the ultimate business PA, saving you time, money and hassle. Your business and your customers deserve the UK's best service. Unrivaled telephone answering from MoneyPenny. Find out more at moneypenny.com.
Listen at 6:30 every weekday morning for your indispensable briefing on the latest politics, business and sports news of the day. Weekday afternoons on Times Radio, sponsored by Solar with Hive. Find out how you can make the switch to solar simple and easy at hivehome.com. Hive, know your power.
I will be you combined as one, a beautiful melding of Fee and Jane Fane.
You are just so superb. How you managed to put that together in the time that it took to just play a couple of beautifully crafted, may I say, advertisements is just extraordinary. Congratulations to you for that, and that is quite funny. So that's just going to come back and haunt you a lot. I'm so
it's
sorry.
Wonderful. I'm going to have to live up to that beautiful, and the words make love to you, baby. Yeah.
Let's not dwell on that. Coming up after 3:30, the biologist Richard Dawkins in conversation with Tom. Every day at that time in the afternoons, you do hear a fantastic interview with a brilliant guest. If you miss it, fear not, because you can listen to it on our podcast, Off Air with Jane and Fee. Even when Jane Garvey's away, it is always Off Air with Jane and Fee, because it is with Jane Mulcairns. There's a new episode every Monday to Thursday, so if you've listened to us in the afternoons on Times Radio and you want more, or perhaps, you know, you're in a hostage situation or something like that, you can listen with your local podcast provider of choice. You can hear all of our 3:30 interviews in full, including Ed Davey, Jerry Halliwell, Jeremy Vine, Laura Bates, hundreds of other guests. And this week we were joined by writer and niece of Donald Trump. That is Mary Trump. She told us she hopes that world leaders will stand up to her presidential uncle.
I get that it seems like the safest thing to do in the moment to appease Donald so that he lowers tariffs or he doesn't take another dangerous step against your country. But that's a short-term solution that isn't going to end well. And I've been hoping for a long time that world leaders would unite, would create a united front and recognize that the best way to deal with somebody like Donald is to confront him relentlessly and not back down.
You can hear that and many, many, many other episodes wherever you get your podcasts from. So your money or your life is meant to be a thing of the past. But yesterday we brought you the story of a crypto investor who was kidnapped, tortured and held at gunpoint after failing to hand over his password to his crypto funds. It's the latest in a wave of global attacks. The Wall Street Journal's Angus Berwick told us more.
I mean, what's driving this is, you know, the price of Bitcoin, along with sway of other cryptocurrencies, has really kind of exploded over the last 6 months. I mean, you know, one Bitcoin is now worth like almost $110,000. Criminals are obviously kind of, you know, are very aware of this, that many people are sitting on these absolute gold mines of tokens and are kind of actively kind of seeking out vulnerable targets who they can extort them for their passwords, kidnap their relatives, try to gain access to, for instance, like a hard drive on which they actually hold the cryptocurrencies. And we're seeing these cases kind of pop up all across the globe at the moment.
Well, today we're joined by Sujit Ruman, Chief Legal Officer at blockchain intelligence agency TRM Labs. He's also a former federal prosecutor and one-time advisor on crypto for the US Department of Justice. You're very welcome to the programme. Would you agree with Angus's analysis yesterday of what is going on here?
I would. I think certainly part of what's going on here is that as the price of Bitcoin goes up, criminals are very smart. They know where the money is. And so they're targeting people who are perceived to have high net worth. And so it's very tragic. It's very unfortunate. But what we are seeing is a spate of physical attacks on people who are perceived to have crypto in their custody. It does vary a little bit based on, you know, country. We've seen a number of these episodes in France. Obviously, the reporting yesterday from what was happening in Manhattan, in New York. Canada has had a number of these incidents. UK has had a few incidents as well. But overall, it is a very troubling trend.
I suppose what surprises people who don't have cryptocurrency, and, you know, let's remember that is many of us, probably most of us, is that it is about the taking of a password. I would imagine that your cryptocurrency was way safer than that.
Well, it's very interesting because, you know, historically within the crypto community, there's been an idea of if you don't own your crypto, then it's not yours. In other words, if you custody it with a third party, like a cryptocurrency exchange, historically, that's how a lot of retail users have come into crypto, right? You sign up for an account at Coinbase or at Binance or Kraken or any one of these other exchanges, and they custody your funds for you. Now, the sort of more libertarian idea behind crypto is the idea that you shouldn't rely on third parties. You shouldn't rely on intermediaries. And so among the sort of original crypto investors, you know, the people who have really made millions, if not billions of dollars with crypto, the ethos is typically you should custody it yourself. You should maintain your own custody, your own private keys, and not rely on any third party. And that's very interestingly how these high net worth individuals have become targets, because they're not the kind of people who would typically custody their funds, which often, again, number into the millions, if not billions, with some third party, where at least presumably it could be safer. They custody their own funds. And now that, unfortunately, has made them targets.
Yes, that is coming back to bite them on the proverbial. The other thing that I don't understand, Sujit, is why this is blockchain intelligence, isn't it, which I thought meant that you carried on building on something all of the time, and therefore you could equally go back and look at where it came from. So why doesn't that work in favour of the authorities or the person who's trying to chase down their cryptocurrency? Why isn't there always a record of who's got it?
Well, you know, there really always is a record of who's got it. And it's very interesting. There was a very high-profile case just a few months ago in the United States where essentially a ring had set up this whole enterprise to try to steal people's crypto using violent methods. The way that investigators were able to crack that case was by watching how the funds moved, you know, once the victim had been forced to pay their crypto over to this third, to the assailant, and essentially trace that crypto over time and eventually link those wallets to the bad actor who was eventually arrested. So you can use blockchain intelligence. You can use the unique nature of blockchains to identify these bad actors. But it can be difficult because there are certain obfuscating techniques that actors use, whether it's mixers or tumblers, other kinds of technical means of trying to obfuscate their link to the funds. But again, there have been cases where using this kind of intelligence, bad actors have been identified. And actually, the longest prison sentence in history in a crypto-involved case was in that particular violent scheme, 47 years in federal prison for an actor who was linked to that activity through blockchain intelligence.
Are cryptocurrencies per se an opportunity for money launderers to just be having the best time of their lives ever?
It's a great question. You know, I would say that in a very important sense, crypto is a technology, right? Blockchain technology, distributed ledger technology, which is ultimately what crypto is built upon, is a technology. And whether it's positive or whether it's negative, all depends on the user. And so, you know, we see a lot of money laundering when it comes to cash. We see a lot of money laundering when it comes to crypto. Actually, the percentage of money laundering that's associated with crypto, empirically, you can look into it. That's what firms like mine do, is we track these payments over time. And actually, there is less money laundering, less illicit activity in the crypto ecosystem than there is in the ordinary cash economy. But that's not to minimize the fact that bad actors are using the perceived anonymity of cryptocurrency to try to do some very concerning things.
I think if sort of 5 years ago, someone had said to you, we'll be talking about crypto heists and crypto theft, you'd imagine someone sitting in the basement, pulling out some very exciting hacking software, rather than actually just having someone turning up the old-fashioned way and threatening violence until you handed something over. If people have a large amount of cryptocurrency and are listening to this, what should they do? How should they make themselves safer?
No, it's a great question. And I guess there's probably three or four major things to think about. You know, one is to maintain your privacy online. For better or for worse, I think a lot of the crypto community is associated with being quite flashy on social media, showing off your wealth, you know, showing off the Ferraris and the Lamborghinis, et cetera. Which is not to say that all of the victims of these crimes have been those kinds of people, but certainly there is a correlation between crypto wealth and kind of flashy social media presence. Look, that creates its own set of risks. And I think what a lot of people also don't recognize when they're on social media is that sometimes, you know, let's say you take a photograph and there's metadata in that photograph, you can actually physically pinpoint where that person is, right? And so that's a very sort of core cybersecurity precaution that people should take. Turn off that metadata. Be conscious about what you're posting on social media. Be thoughtful about, you know, how real-time your updates are. Because if people can track you based on your social media presence or what you're posting online, that potentially could make you a bigger target than you otherwise would be. The other point we would make is obviously strengthen your physical security. And this is really more focused on folks with very high net worth, you know, people who really are targets for these types of physical assaults. Install robust home security systems. Use secure transport arrangements. Maybe even employ personal security, bodyguards if you need to. But if you're somebody who is worth, you know, tens of millions, if not billions of dollars or pounds, that's probably something you should be thinking about very, very carefully.
Mm. Or just don't be super rich and don't show off about it. I mean, you know, there are some things that haven't changed throughout time there, aren't there? One quick question before we lose you. What should governments be doing to try and ensure that the future of cryptocurrencies and the safety of the people using them is really being looked at properly?
Well, I think one very important thing to do is to create regulatory structures around crypto that help create guardrails and create rules, right? The more that the industry comes out of the shadows, which it really is, I would say 5, 6, 7 years ago, the regulatory structures around crypto globally, whether it's in the UK, which has a quite mature regulatory system around digital assets, which is enhancing as we speak, it was a very different scenario. It was very much a Wild West kind of mentality. But the more that governments can do to create guardrails, create regulatory structures, normalize the financial system the multi-trillion dollar financial system that has grown around digital assets, I think the safer we will all be. So create the rules, enforce the rules, make sure that they're transparent, and that creates safety for everyone.
And will that be difficult to do? Is there something in the very nature of cryptocurrencies whereby people don't want that kind of regulatory liaison with the government? It's just, you know, that's not the right fit for their look and their brand.
I think the biggest difficulty is that so much of the existing rules that are out there, the money laundering rules, the rules around whether or not something is a security, which requires disclosure obligations, at least in the United States, a lot of those laws were written in the 1930s or maybe updated in the 1970s. But this technology is revolutionary in how it arranges information through the use of distributed ledgers, through the use of distributed computing. And so that technology is fundamentally different than what was in place, again, in the 1930s or the 1970s when a lot of these laws were updated. I think that is the biggest challenge, right? We need lawmakers who understand the technology and can build guardrails that do address the very legitimate concerns around money laundering or illicit use of crypto, while also understanding the upsides, the real potential for this technology to democratize financial services, to cut out a lot of the fees and rent seeking that institutions like financial institutions sometimes impose. I think that is the challenge. Lawmakers understanding the technology and building it in a way that creates safety, but also allows for innovation.
Really interesting stuff. Thank you very much indeed for that. So that is Sujit Ruman, who is Chief Legal Officer at TMR Labs, which is a blockchain intelligence agency. Have you invested yet in cryptocurrency?
About 15 years ago, my wife, who is also a freelance, well, she was a freelance journalist then, she wrote a piece about this new cryptocurrency thing. And we ummed and ahed and we thought, go on, should we like put your freelance fee and buy a few Bitcoin with it? And obviously we didn't, which is why I'm now sitting here working rather than just putting my feet up, being one of those people being attacked with wrenches in
Manhattan apartments.
Do you often think about it?
I rarely don't think about it.
Okay, oh gosh. I've ruined it already. We were doing so well, Tom.
You have.
I think most people just still have that feeling that you are, you're entering a kind of Wild West. I think that point about regulation is just so important before people like me are ever going to put the money into it. And also, I do think until I can buy a pair of pants in Marks and Spencer's with my cryptocurrency coin, I can't see a future for
it's
it.
It's phenomenally hard to use. I had to buy some illegal testosterone for a piece once off the dark web from a guy who also sells sniper rifles. Anyway, coming up, our big interview is with Richard Dawkins. But first, let's get a check on the news headlines with Andy Hayes.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you, Tom. Good afternoon.
The Prime Minister has claimed it would be Liz Truss all over again if voters were to support Reform UK's economic policies. Sir Keir Starmer claims that just like the former Tory PM, Reform leader Nigel Farage is making promises he can't keep. Reform says it would reinstate winter fuel payments and drop the two-child benefit cap and says it would cut spending in other areas. Police say a 9-year-old child was among those injured when a car drove into people at Liverpool FC's title parade on Monday. Officers say the victims' ages range from 9 to 78. All are understood to be British. Police have until this evening to question a 53-year-old man from West Derby in Liverpool on suspicion of attempted murder, dangerous driving and drug driving. And the UK government has criticised Israel's plans to establish 22 new settlements in the occupied West Bank. They include new ones as well as those which already were established without permission and will now be legal under Israeli law. One minister says the move will further imperil Palestinian statehood. But settler leader Daniela Weiss says she wants to push for new settlements in Gaza.
There will not be Palestinian state between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean. Never, ever. The goal is clear, to prevent any option of establishing any kind of state in the heartland of Israel.
And you can hear detailed analysis of the biggest developments in global security on our World in 10 podcast.
This is Times Radio.
Amazon offers employees up to £8,000 for education and training, like Juliet. She's now a trained technician. And to her, the sound of machinery in need of repair reminds her of how far she's come. In 2 years, she's landed her dream job, providing her with valuable skills. That's up to £8,000 for education and training at Amazon. Eligibility conditions apply.
Jen had a great idea. Jen set up a new company. Jen was excited. Jen knew she needed insurance, but she couldn't find the right package to suit her needs. And that's when the penny dropped. Jen got in contact with her Bieber insurance broker, Ben. Ben gave helpful advice and found competitive rates from a choice of insurers that would cover her needs. Every business owner needs a Ben. To find yours, call 0800 999 775 or go to benthebroker.co.uk today.
With Wild Frontiers, you'll see more with those who know the way. Experience nomadic culture on a journey along the Silk Road. Watch the sun rise over the ruins of Tikal in Guatemala. Or learn the secrets of Japanese cuisine in Kyoto. On a Wild Frontiers adventure, you'll have the freedom to take it all in, to never stop seeking. Visit wildfrontierstravel.com for expertly crafted tours that take you further.
The day's big stories and tomorrow's front pages. Saturday and Sunday nights from 10 with Daryl Morris.
Weekday afternoons on Times Radio, sponsored by Solar with Hive. Find out why Solar could be right for you at hivehome.com. Hive, know your power.
With his book, The Selfish Gene, Richard Dawkins introduced hundreds of thousands to Darwin, to evolution, and to Dawkins himself, with a gene's eye view of how evolution works. The 83-year-old British evolutionary biologist and author went on to write about more than a dozen books about evolution and a couple, possibly even more famously, about God. Now, 50 years on from his first book, he's back on genes and has published The Genetic Book of the Dead. I spoke to Richard and started by asking why he wrote it.
It's pretty much a continuation of The Selfish Gene. As you say, that's 50 years ago.
The thesis is that any animal, including us, is a written record, a document recording the environments in which our ancestors survived and passed on their genes. We can't actually read the book yet, only in rather crude form. But my conjecture is that the zoologist of the future, whom I call SOF, scientist of the future, will be able to read not only the bodies of animals, but the genomes as well, and read them as an account of the environments in which the ancestors lived.
And what would that mean? I mean, I think of myself as someone who's living in the 21st century. I'm perfectly adapted to being on the radio and writing things. But what would my DNA say?
It would be a palimpsest. It would be a succession of overwritten accounts of ancient worlds and then slightly less ancient worlds and then slightly more recent worlds, etc., because we are the product of a natural selection process which has been going on throughout geological time. And the earlier records are partly obliterated, but only partly.
What does it mean that we're a palimpsest rather than a new book? How is the way in which I and other creatures have evolved differently than if you had just written on a blank piece of paper to design them for now?
Well, there are mistakes. I mean, we do have anomalies which wouldn't be there if we were designed from scratch. My favourite example is the laryngeal nerve, the recurrent laryngeal nerve, which takes a remarkable detour, especially in an animal like a brontosaurus or a giraffe, where it goes way, way down into the chest before turning turtle and then right back up to the larynx. And that's a historical relic of our fish ancestors, when the most direct route of that nerve was straight from the brain to the gills. And that would have been what happened is that it got hooked around a major artery in the chest. And as the mammalian neck lengthened, especially in a giraffe, the detour just got longer and longer. So this is a historical record, a kind of anomaly, which if you started with a clean drawing board, you wouldn't do.
Yes. Are there any other examples from your book about it? I mean, is this... Quite apart from anything else, there's a lot of great natural history writing in there. Tell me about cuckoos.
Cuckoos are great because they are, everybody knows what cuckoos do. They dump their eggs in other species' nests and they cash in on the parental instincts of the other species, like reed warblers or meadow pipits or whatever it is. But what is remarkable is that the eggs of the cuckoo mimic those of the host species. Well, that's good enough, but what's even better is that there are many different host species. I just mentioned reed warblers and meadow pipits. There are lots more. And a female cuckoo that lays an egg in a meadow pipit nest lays an egg that looks like a meadow pipit egg. A female cuckoo that lays an egg in a reed warbler's nest, it looks like a reed warbler egg, but it's the same species of cuckoo. So somehow the same species of cuckoo manages to lay the different colours of eggs. And the answer to the riddle, it lies on what's not called the Y chromosome, but it's kind of is the same as the Y chromosome. As you know, in mammals, the male sex is the XY sex. The male sex is the sex that has the odd sex chromosome. The female has the same sex chromosomes, both X's. In birds, it's the other way around. So what we have here is lineages of female birds who imprint upon the nest that their mother laid the egg in. So a female that was reared in a meadow pipit nest chooses to lay her own eggs in a meadow pipit nest. And so you have a great cultural lineage of females, meadow pipit females, reed warbler females, etc. females. And if we assume that the egg coloration is coded on the Y chromosome, that would explain it, because the Y chromosome has experience of nothing but meadow pipit, not nothing but back a long way, meadow pipit nests or another Y chromosome would have experience of Reed warbler nests. And so it's the possibility arises of accumulation of genes for making meadow pipit mimic eggs in one lineage of females and Reed warbler mimic eggs in another lineage of females. And because these lineages are culturally imprinted upon the same host species, it works.
Why did you decide to take this particular approach to writing about evolution? I mean, you had a diversion into God, but you've got a sort of large section of books about evolution. What do you think this adds and does differently that the others don't?
The gene is the unit of natural selection. Natural selection is all about the differential survival of genes. A lot of people get that wrong. And if you get that right, once you understand that, everything makes sense. So I've had a kind of mission to try to propound this point. It's not my own. I mean, it's part of the neo-Darwinian synthesis of the 1930s and 40s, but the message of that never really quite possibly properly caught on.
And so in this, did you feel that this completes your task of doing? I mean, if 50 years on, you're still writing about the gene, have you failed?
No, because if you actually look at what people are doing out in the field, if you go to the Serengeti or if you go to the Antarctic, where people are actually working on animals in the field, they're all asking the question, how does this behavior benefit the genes of the animal? And that wasn't true 50 years ago.
Does it help us in any way that we're a palimpsest? Having all of this sort of genetic history knocking around, might it ever, within our evolution, looking at it over an evolutionary period of time, does the existence of adaptations to things in the past, is this ever a source material that can be drawn on in the future?
Well, I suppose it possibly could. I mean, I don't know whether you're familiar with the discipline of Darwinian medicine, where Randy Nessy and George Williams wrote a book trying to encourage doctors to take a Darwinian view of their patients and of the pathogens that affect their patients. And so I suppose that would be an example.
The title of it, and indeed the title of your tour was The Final Bow, and the title of the book feels sort of alarmingly elegiac as well. But I would notice that this final bow, I went to see one of your final bows many months ago, and you're still doing a final bow today at the Hay Festival. How final is this, and how serious
That only applied to America. It was my final bow in America.
And do you have any other plans for books?
Yes, I'm working on a book at the moment. Its provisional title is Tales from Haeckel. Haeckel was the German Darwin, I mean, he was a great admirer of Darwin. He was also, unlike Darwin, he was a great artist. And so the book is, each chapter begins with a picture from Haeckel, and then it's a tale based upon the animal that he drew. He drew the most exquisite pictures of animals, especially protozoa. And so it's just a collection of essays inspired by the art of this zoologist artist.
Oh, well, that sounds fabulous. And I'm pleased that it's not final in the book sense. I'm pleased you're still going. Looking back, though, over your career, what do you feel is happening in science now? When you look at, to get you expansive as the elder statesman of science that you are, what's the state of the...
I don't like the sound of that at all.
I'll be less coy in my questioning then, and maybe you can be less coy in your answering. How do you feel about how things are going on in the States?
Well, I mean, it's appalling, of course. I mean, but thank goodness, I mean, it's only going to be 4 years. Presumably it's going to be only 4 years, but I mean, it is terrible. I mean, the man is a thug and a barbarian, illiterate and lazy and vain and all sorts of things. It's truly terrible that he got elected twice. But you don't need me to tell you that. Everybody knows that in this country. Everybody outside America knows that.
But do you feel like... So it feels like the arguments of the early noughties that you were at the front of, the arguments about religion, about creationism, about atheism, it feels like all of these things have quietened down a bit, but there's something slightly more, certainly if you chat to scientists in the States, something slightly more sort of fundamentals going on
and perhaps existential scientists. Do you chat to your colleagues there?
Yeah, there is an assault on science coming from two directions. I mean, it's coming on the one hand from the extreme right. I mean, Trump is waging a war on intellectual life generally, but science as well. I mean, appointing Robert Kennedy Jr. as the Minister of Health, I mean, an anti-vax fanatic, a lunatic, it is not a science-friendly move, and the effect he's having on curtailing and cancelling scientific grants and things is just part of the general thuggery. But coming from the left, there's also an assault on science in the form of things like the denial of the reality of sex and the preaching of the idea that your sex is what you feel it to be rather than what objective science tells you it is. So that there is an attack on science coming from both directions.
Leaving with something perhaps slightly more sort of whimsical from the book, I have a pet tortoise, and you talk in the book about the history of these actually tortoises, but also hippos. Explain to me what their palimpsest says about their sort of unusual paths.
Well, tortoises are remarkable because although it's true that quite a lot of animals, having come out of the sea, I mean, our remote ancestor, the lowest level of the palimpsest is in the sea. And then quite a lot of animals, having come out of the sea, a few million years later, troop back again. So whales are an example, an extreme case. Dugongs and manatees are another one. But there are lots of others less extreme, like sea lions and turtles, who've pretty much turtles entirely went gone back to the sea, except to come back to lay their eggs. But tortoises are descended from marine turtles, so the ancestry of tortoises is originally in the sea as fish. Then they came out of the sea as land animals, went back to the sea as turtles, and then returned to the land as land tortoises, including some desert tortoises. So that they've done a doubling back, which is, I think, unique.
It adds an ability to my tortoise Sophocles' life.
It does, yes.
That was Richard Dawkins telling me about the nobility of my tortoise Sophocles. This is Times Radio.
Great name. I didn't realise that at the start.
It's a Greek tortoise.
So Sophocles and Sesame was the tortoise that has gone missing for a month as well. All the S's are there. Robert Jenrick may have got himself into a little bit more bother than he anticipated with the video content that he has created stopping fare dodgers at Stratford Station in East London. Please note, it is the Shadow Justice Secretary that we're talking about, and a bit of a hoo-ha is developing because, according to TfL, a commercial filming licence is required before filming any commercial or promotional content on the TfL network. This is detailed in our conditions of carriage and is to ensure all footage captured is undertaken with the correct health and safety guidance and insurance. There's also a charge for the use of the TfL brand within commercial content. Now, that's taken from TfL's website. It's not TfL putting this out in response to Robert Jenrick, but an awful lot of people have gone in search of what the actual rules are when you go and you take your phone out and you start filming people on the network. So watch this space. We'll see what happens there. You are listening to Times Radio. Jane Mulcairn's like a gorgeous, gorgeous waft of a very palatable perfume emerges in the studio at this time on a Thursday afternoon to basically spritz us all into our early weekend. We will talk about lots of things. There's a really, really cracking piece that both Tom and I have really enjoyed in the Saturday Times magazine about fostering. Yes, and Jane is making the heart symbol and we heart it too. So we will talk about that in a couple of moments' time. You're listening to Fee Glover and Tom Whipple on Times Radio, sponsored by Solar with Hive. Find out how you can make the switch to Solar simple and easy at hivehome.com.
Ed Vasey on Times Radio with ServiceNow, the AI platform for business transformation. Join Ed Vasey and a host of heavyweight guests every Friday as they take the political temperature of the nation, guiding you through all the day's news, politics and culture on the show where sharp insight meets original thinking. Ed Vasey, tomorrow morning from 10 on Times Radio with ServiceNow. Find out how AI agents can work for your people at servicenow.com.
Download the free Times Radio app and listen to us wherever you are.
This is the sound of a forehand shot. And this is the sound of a backhand shot. Hear the difference? Thankfully, some things are obvious. Like choosing Interactive Investor for your personal pension. As a Which-recommended SIP provider, with a low flat fee and a wide choice of investment options, the choice is obvious.
Advantage Wendy!
Search Interactive Investor Personal Pension. SIP values can fluctuate and you could get back less than you invest.
At Aberdeen Asian Income Fund, we understand Asia because we're here. For over 30 years, we've been on the ground, searching for the most compelling and high-performing companies across the Asia-Pacific region. But it's not just about capital growth. Asia offers abundant opportunities for those seeking income. Unlock Asia's potential and invest with us today. Search Aberdeen Asian Income Fund online to find out more. When investing, please remember that your capital is at risk.
Is call handling causing a headache for your business? MoneyPenny has the answer. MoneyPenny's telephone answering service blends brilliant people and AI technology to create the ultimate business PA, saving you time, money and hassle. Your business and your customers deserve the UK's best service. Unrivaled telephone answering from MoneyPenny. Find out more at moneypenny.com.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Now, quite a few people don't give a stuff about TfL guidelines. Lisa is just one person who says, really? Robert Jenrick is not my jam, but if he wants to put himself out there for all to see and to witness what a plum he is, then let him go ahead. So we just, I think that for me is the text of the day. Jane Mulcairns is the associate editor at the Times Magazine and joins us now to give us a sneak peek into the weekend's edition. So we were talking about this fostering piece. It's just so beautiful and it's very honest. Mm. This is Caroline Scott and her husband, who've been both parents and foster carers. She reveals what it takes to look after children traumatised by neglect and abuse and why, aged 54, she adopted one of them. It's not a hugely long piece, but boy, it packs a punch, doesn't it?
I'd say it's a 3 or 4 tissue read, just in 2,400 words. And there's a lot in the mag that's sometimes quite heavy, including this week as well. But this, I think it will restore your faith in humanity, and it should. So Caroline Scott's got 4 children. And when they started fostering, they're between the ages of 18 and 9. And she says she says one of her siblings said he thought that she wasn't completely happy unless mildly overwhelmed. And you think there's something in that. So 4 kids already, you know, a job as a journalist. But she said that she had a kind of deep rooted desire to foster that came from her own mother, who had grown up in an orphanage in Liverpool. And this is a sentence that really got me. She said that her mother had described to her that she was stripped of all her clothes and separated from her 3 sisters. And when she wet the bed out of fear and misery, she was made to stand alone in the corner of an empty room with a soiled sheet over her head for hours. Ooh. Until it dried. And she said she described all of this to me with a kind of detached fascination, but she never forgot the casual violence of adults or the utter powerlessness of little children. And Caroline's just written this beautiful piece about the difficulties and challenges, but the joys of fostering. And the purpose of this piece really is to talk about the real shortage of foster parents and foster families, and how the fostering network really wants people who might not have considered fostering to think about it. They're trying to appeal to empty nesters who've got, you know, spare room in their houses, but also the time and the ability to do this, because it isn't something you can do, you know, a half an hour a day. You do have to be there for these children, but it is also incredibly poorly paid. You know, you're not remunerated.
She goes through the economics of it and works out that it's about 70 pence an hour.
Yeah. to do probably the most important job you can do, to raise a child. Yeah. And people do it because they are really committed to doing it and committed to these children. Yeah, I would really point everyone to reading this piece this weekend. And, you know, perhaps some people who may not have thought it's for them might even just consider it. Have a look on the Bernardo's website or the Fostering Network's website. I'm sure that there are a lot of people out there who could give a kid a comb.
I think it will definitely nudge some people towards looking into it a little bit more. It's so well worth a read. I mean, it's got the heartwarming stories of joy in there too, and you're absolutely right to point out it's got the downside as well, and just the things that she has realised are really wrong with the system. Mm. So when they've become very attached to a child in their care and the child is really happy in their care, sometimes that child has just been moved on, so they've got to go and start all over again with another family, albeit it might be, you know, for a longer period of time, and hopefully it is. But it's very well worth your time. That's what I would say.
Absolutely. Yeah. 100% worth your time.
And then we've got this piece from Anthony Lloyd and Don McCullen in Palmyra. It's a fascinating and amazing piece. It's hard to classify what it is. Is it a road trip? Is it a reminiscence? Is it a memoir? Tell us about it.
I guess it's a war correspondence buddy road trip. Yeah, that's exactly what I'd say it is. It's a significantly longer piece, but it is, I mean, it's a hell of a read. So Anthony Lloyd, our incredible war correspondent at the Times and former soldier, goes back to Syria with Don McCullen, who is 89 now, who's a legendary photographer. Don hadn't been back to Syria for about 20 years, I think. So there's a lot of history in this piece. There's a lot of kind of context. There's a lot of really entertaining stuff about their relationship, how they met, the kind of ups and downs. And there's also these incredible passages in which sort of Anthony talks about Don McCullen. I mean, there are some ways in which he describes him, which I just think every man would want to be described. He says that there's a couple of Don McCullens. There's a real one and then the more saintly version, which plays the public's expectation of him. The first is complicated, impassioned, warm, gracious and extremely amusing. The other is some of the former masked by a projection. The space between the two can be vexing. And then he talks about what Don talks about when they're on the road, and he says he's a great storyteller and tales of distant war, of fading seducers, of actresses, mercenaries, of high adventure and grief and loss and laughter formed milestones to the desert ride. I mean, wouldn't you love to be described like that? Is that the way that you think your desk mates describe you down on the 11th floor?
Wasted my 20s. He's also, one of the things I like about it is the honesty, though, and Anthony's very good at this. He talks about what it is to be a war correspondent. He talks about how men and women who cover conflict feel an obligation to emphasise how terrible war is, because the alternative of admitting to the bounties of professional and personal success in charting the excoriating depths of other people's pain can be too difficult. And he's got a lot about analysing why he does it, but I think the standout bit of it for me is just the opening image where you see what Palmyra used to be before ISIS turned up, and you see what it is now, and that's just heartbreaking.
Yeah, absolutely. And we don't know where it's going. You know, obviously Syria's in a new phase. Also, I would like to point out I'd learnt a new word in this piece. Is it Kankerem?
I think
it's Kankerem. Quinkerem or Kankerem. I had to look it up. It's a type of ancient warship, specifically a galley propelled by five banks of oars on each side. And this is the word used to describe Charlie Glass, the journalist, who glided in through the front door like a Kankerem, Quinkerem, acting in an entitled manner. That's the way I like to breeze into your studio on a Thursday, Fee.
Can I just say I knew that? And that, my friends, is a total victory for the University of Canterbury, the alumni of 1987 to 1990. There's nothing intimidating about this studio at all. Tom, it's been lovely. We will do it again sometime. That's it from us for today. Jane Garvey is back on Monday from 2. Our producer today was Felix Forbes. Our technical operator was Ryan Boyden. Thank you to Jay Mulkerins as well. Up next, it's John Pienaar with Drive. Have a very good evening.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Fee. Thank you, Tom. At 4 o'clock, I'm John Pienaar with Times Radio Drive. Here are the headlines. Keir Starmer hints he could ease the two-child benefit cap, saying he's determined to drive down child poverty. And a rally in global markets has lost steam after a court blocked Donald Trump's so-called Liberation Day tariffs. Coming up, we'll try to figure out what happens next as the world waits for Donald Trump's response to the pause on his tariff plans. Well, the obstacle. We're expecting a White House press briefing a bit later, so stay with us. We'll have that for you as it happens, and I'll be talking to a former GCHQ cyber expert as the government announces plans to scale up its own cyber attacks against hostile nations.
This is Times Radio.
Now the news with Andy Hayes.
Thank you, John. Good afternoon. Sir Keir Starmer has given his strongest hints yet that he will concede ground on the two-child benefit cap. While refusing to commit to scrapping the limit, the PM, who's facing a backbench rebellion over welfare plans, did say this.
I'm determined we're going to drive down child poverty. One of the proudest things that the last Labour government did was to drive down child poverty, and that's why we've got a task force working on this. I think there are a number of components. There isn't a single bullet, but I'm absolutely determined that we will drive this down, and that's why we'll look at all options.
He's also claimed that Reform UK's economic plans would be Liz Truss all over again. He's accusing Nigel Farage of not funding proposed benefits increases, but Reform says it would make some big spending cuts. The White House says it will appeal a court decision that Donald Trump exceeded his authority when he announced sweeping taxes on imported goods. Tariffs are typically approved by Congress, but the US president argued he had the power to act because it was a national emergency. Andrew Hale is a senior analyst of trade policy at the Heritage Foundation, the US think tank which helped to form Trump's policies. He's told Times Radio the Trump team was well aware of the risks on tariffs.
I said to the campaign, someone at the campaign told me when they announced last year they were going to use emergency legislation, I said no president has the authority to impose a baseline tariff of 10%, 20%, or anything like that on the whole world. The office of the president doesn't have that power. And they said, oh, don't worry, we'll use emergency legislation. And I said, well, that'll be illegal. And they said, well, we'll just try it anyway and see how it goes.
Hamas says it's received a proposal from US Special Envoy Steve Witkoff for a ceasefire in Gaza and is studying it. According to Israeli media, the plan calls for a 60-day halt in fighting during which 9 living hostages and half of those who have died would be released. It would theoretically take place in 2 phases over the course of a week. Robert Jenrick, the Shadow Justice Secretary, has confronted fare dodgers on the London Underground. He claims law-breaking is out of control in the capital. Transport for London says about 1 in every 25 passengers is not paying, but Jenrick says he fears it's a lot more serious than that. He's told Times Radio's Hugo Rifkind that this sort of crime is chipping away at civilised behaviour.
I do think that we all have a role in society to call people out. If you see somebody chucking litter on the floor, it's not somebody else's problem. Frankly, it's not just the police who should step up or the local council. Well, I mean,
One of the men you spoke to said he was carrying a knife, didn't he?
He said that to me, yeah. Yeah. No, he threatened me. Look, I don't want anyone to put themselves in danger.
A drought has been declared in northwest England. The Environment Agency says the region's had the third lowest rainfall between February and April since 1871. Experts are warning people to be mindful about their water usage as reservoir and rivers remain very low. And remember, you can hear the Times' renowned foreign correspondents analyse the biggest global security stories every day on our World in 10 podcast.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. John Pienaar at Drive on Times Radio.
Hello, I'm John Pienaar. Good to have you here on Drive on Times Radio. Thanks for joining me. Now, suddenly, while we here in Britain were sleeping, President Trump's world-changing grand plan to tear up the rules of the global economy came unstuck. The plan was to hammer importers with crippling trade tariffs, import taxes, though the president doesn't call them that, drive consumers to buy homegrown stuff, force companies to make stuff in the USA and employ more Americans. And since only Congress and not the president can levy tariffs, well, just say that free trade has been so unfair to America that it's a national emergency. And then President Trump can do what he likes. That was the plan. What could possibly go wrong? Well,
everything could go wrong, and a few hours ago, everything did. The US Court of International Trade ruled that the Constitution and the law mean what they say when they decree the President can't actually do what he likes, the Congress is there for a reason, and anyway, a trade deficit with this or that country, and somewhere there's no trade deficit at all, like Britain, doesn't actually amount to a national emergency. So, the judges ruled, cancel the US trade tariffs on which Trump has based most of his economic strategy. And by the way, crippling import taxes also whack up prices for American consumers and businesses, though President Trump denies that. But whoever said his plan to tear up the global economy and put it back together in the way that he likes made sense, apart from President Trump and his loyal team, I mean. So now what? Well, maybe find other ways, obscure ancient pieces of law to justify the tariff war. But what would the judges make of that? And will Congress step up? And what do countries, including the EU, do now? They're looking for a trade deal to soften the blow of the tariffs that the court has now judged illegal. And what about us, Britain? We just reached a trade agreement with America, and Keir Starmer had a rare happy day boasting about it. What'll happen to that deal? Well, the short answer is no one knows. And uncertainty is never good for business. Not in America, not here, not anywhere. And the fuller, useful answer is, well, it's what we'll try to find out on today's show. In a moment, I'm going to be talking to a US legal expert. And the leading trade economist also is with me. And later, Erwin Stelzer, one of America's most respected economic commentators, is going to be joining us live. Now, can't promise they are going to see into the future. But I hope they're going to leave us a bit more clued up than we are just now. At least, that is the plan. Tell me what you're thinking. Send me a text, 87222. Start with the word Times, maybe a voice note on WhatsApp to 0333-003-2353. That's 0333-003-2353. First thing, let me welcome to the programme Greg Nunziata, who's Executive Director of the Society for the Rule of Law. Greg, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me, Dan.
Thank you for joining us, Greg. The Court of International Trade ruling landed, didn't it, like a bit of a bombshell, and it's reverberated around the world. But can it be called a total surprise? I mean, the use of historic emergency powers to hand out trade tariffs by the president, that always seemed a dubious way of going about things.
It always did seem dubious, and there's lots of levels on which it was dubious legally. You know, we in this country have, over the last century, granted more and more emergency powers to the president. But even, you know, before Trump came around, there has been a turn away from this. The federal judiciary is asking Congress really to do more of the policy setting, to do its job, to not delegate to the president, to not let the president make significant policy decisions. But particularly here, we're talking about trade, which is, as you mentioned, you know, tariffs are given, the authority to set tariffs are given to Congress by the Constitution.